Accession number 26864, reel 14.
Arthur Caney, reel 14. So as you were saying, the trouble was that the troops were going back, weren't they?
Yes, the battalion left, and they left at 10 o'clock in the morning, and at 12 o'clock, the second commander, who was staying behind with me as a training major, and myself, had to meet with Idi Amin, who was then the CO of that group, that unit.
And what was the name of your camp? I'm sorry, I haven't got that.
It was Ginger.
Ginger.
Ginger Barracks.
Right,
J-I-N-G-A, Ginger Barracks.
Thank you.
It was a solid, well-built, permanent camp. Everything had been there for years, not many years. It was well, comfortable.
Yeah. Right.
So the troops left, and I had a telephone call where they left a grenade in the drawer in my quarters for safety in case I was in trouble, which I thought was fair enough. Anyway, we had to meet at 12 o'clock. In the camp, and the British troops had left, except they'd left one platoon in the distance, in the wood at the back, who could see, they could see the window of the headquarters where we were meeting Idi Amin. This was a meeting to decide what was going to happen. Now, if at 12 o'clock they hadn't pulled the curtain across, they would come to assist us, because they think we would be in trouble. So we were really acting as guinea pigs to see what Edie was going to do. So around about a minute past 12, I looked up. We hadn't moved the curtain, so I fortunately had to give the 2IC a tip. So he went across and pulled it across, and obviously then the platoon left. So we were then under the control. Well, we were a training team then attached to Edie, but under his command, up to a point.
So what was his attitude during this meeting?
Oh, he was, as before, wonderful. You see, the Africans treated us as someone who was giving them something. We were there to look after them. I mean, I had many occasions where they would knock on my door and come in and look very miserable in front of me and say, "You are my father. I am in trouble. You must help me." And that's exactly the attitude of all of them around. We were there to help. Oh, that was funny thing. I used to get warning, though, from the RSM. Somebody's going to come and see you, and they've got trouble at home. A home was about 6 days' walk away. So I was always primed before they came to see me. So I really was able to look after them.
Yeah. So what was Edie's reaction to the mutiny and the...
Well, Edie had been at the mutiny. Edie had been on safari with his company. So when he came back, he was really nothing to do with it. Whether he'd organised it or not, I don't know. But he came with all his people. They were not involved in it. But as soon as the British troops had gone, and we then became a training team of a 2IC, a training major, paymaster, myself, and the MTO, that's four people only. We were the training team. So therefore, everything was going to go well, and it looked well. And then my wife joined, my wife returned. Now, because of the mutiny, and the few days after the troops left, the battalion was very miserable. The troops were going around with glum faces, and they were not very... except when they come to work in the office with us. But generally speaking, the atmosphere was not very good.
Why was that? Because...
Well, because of the mutiny, they were ashamed of it.
Right.
But as soon as my wife arrived in that camp, everything changed. Smiling faces and happy, because I think they could see that we were going to stay. That's what I think it was. And they knew, because my wife came back, that we had trust in them. Now, that's the way I think it was. Well, I know it was, actually. And I felt the same.
Yeah.
So there we are, a very happy time that was.
Yeah. Did you feel at all unsafe or insecure?
No.
Now there are only just
no, no,
a
no.
few of you.
Well, I wouldn't have let my wife come back. No.
Yeah.
No. Never at any time with those troops did I feel insecure.
Right. And your wife obviously felt quite happy and comfortable then.
Well, she refused to go away. But unfortunately, we then had coming to the headquarters in Entebbe, a senior man from the UK was the, happened to be the who hadn't been with African troops, skilled man no doubt in his job, to help them on the staff work. But unfortunately he didn't help me because he couldn't understand the things I was doing. And when I had to give a report quickly on how much it cost to produce another two battalions, he didn't like the fact that I had told the government direct. But that was one of these things which the Africans who I'd organised with me and backed me up.
I imagine the British government were quite upset that Mobote had sent people to Russia for training. I mean, this was...
Well, no, that, war, yes. We? Well, yeah, well, that's war. The start of being independent. They were independent. Mm. That was a shocker, really, because the standard of those coming back was so bad that, well, I had a bit of trouble with the Africans there with me.
Really?
They'd sorted them out. But that was the start of the building up to the mutiny, I think.
So you went up to Karamoja up in the police Piper, didn't you? And you went up by car 3 months later.
Yeah, well, I went up to see about the camp. And what I found, that the DO had selected an area, and it was easy to find an area for a camp, because it was wide open spaces, and you could find the place secure, you could find the water. And then, wonderful thing I found had happened, a British engineer, Warrant Officer, had been sent to control about 500 prisoners, civilian prisoners. They built a camp for the prisoners, and then they started building a camp, you know, the prisoners, with this one warrant officer to control them, build a camp. Can you? It's wonderful when you think of it, all on his own up there in the wilds. And of course, the prisoners worked so well, they were out. Food, they couldn't go in, it was too far away. Karamoja was right in the sticks. But later when I worked up with my wife with a car, I look back, I think, what a silly thing to do, because although I had a good car, which was a Karmann Gear, one of these low two-seaters, long way to go, and I think back, if I'd had a puncture, if I'd run out of petrol or something, it would have been silly. But we had staging places. In Africa, the DO and certain districts, they have their districts, but they also have having small staging points where you could, at least you had a cover and water, and one man would be there looking after it, sweeping it up and that, but you went self-contained with your food and things, but somewhere to sleep. So therefore in stages we got up there.
And how long did that drive take?
Took about 3 or 4 days.
Quite a journey.
But we'd done a lot of that before. I'd done it all before in the Land Rovers. And I'm doing it. This was the time when the Israeli was there, and I thought, well, let's get away and we'll see a bit of the country before. I knew they couldn't take my job over, but the Africans, which I was training somebody to take over. So it was a good time.
And the Python Hill killing, you've noted down here.
Ah, yes, well, our barracks was called Python Hill. And I heard some shouts. I was in the office there and I heard some shouts and a lot of things. So I went up to see, and there one of our chaps had killed a python. The python had caught a dog. So the screaming was the dog screaming, and everybody, the servants and everybody around shouting. What they'd done, they killed it in the end with an axe. And it took four men to lift it on two broom handles and bury it. Now that python had, it was called Python here, so they must have been there for all the, you know, for years and years. And when you think of it, it could have got children, could have got all sorts of people.
Yeah. And it lived in the barracks, do you think? Or?
Well, it was in the barracks. We had a big wood behind, large wood, where the troops later on were hiding before they're looking at the to see if we were safe enough.
Yes, yeah. Just looking at your notes here, that's right. And you went to Quetta, did you? Or you've written P in Quetta, Q-U-A-T-E-R. Three guinea pigs.
Oh, we've done that. That's for the That was for the...
Right. Oh, yes, for the... When you were... Yeah, in Greengage. Grenade, right, okay. Right. Hussein at the golf club.
Oh, yes. We had Independence game. We had Hussein, the six stars. They were... We had thought we'd introduce them to the local civilians, British, golf club, because they were independents, and if we could see, they would be a good thing for them to learn golf. Now, Hussein was the chap who I thought, had he not been killed by Idi Amin later on, he would have been the man I would thought would have run the country.
Right.
He was more, he was, he would have been, in my opinion, the perfect man, instead of Edie.
Right. And his name was Hussein?
Hussein.
Just Hussein.
Well, later on, I took him to introduce him to the golf people, gave him a golf club, and he stood on the tee, and we told him how to address the golf ball, and he stood at that tee, and he swung back, and I could see that he was going to hit that ball correctly. He had the wonderful coordination and the swing, and I thought, well, how could he do it? He may have been trying for years to do it properly. And he picked up that golf club and he swung it absolutely as though he'd been doing it for years. It's the same with music. They got the musical ear too, like that.
So in a way, I mean, introducing Ugandan people to the golf club, you were still passing on
yes.
the way you'd lived.
Yeah, yes.
To them, really.
Oh, yes. Oh, for years. For quite the time I was there, we invited him in the house. We always got on so well with them. And Edie, up to that time, he had been very good.
And you've written Head in Fridge later.
Ah, yeah. When I got back to England, and we heard the stories about Idi Amin's sorting out his staff. In the army there, which was left, according to the Time magazine, he'd killed Hussein, who was the one which he would have been frightened of. He would have been, should have taken over. But he was not senior. And according to the Time magazine, he put his head in the fridge and would take it out and put it on the table and talk to it. But I'd seen other stories with his wife. His wife was chopped up, sewn back on again, and stood... This is the Time magazine. Whether we believe it or not, well, I've heard the story many times. And she was put in the children's nursery. And he then told that this will not happen to you, he would tell the children. But that's a thing which I can't confirm.
Do you think he was capable of that?
I know he was now. Oh, the things, oh dear, the stories I know now. I mean, once we left, it became tribal. And, you see, Obote was not the perfect, he was not the best of Prime Minister.
What was wrong with him?
When I met him first, he shook hands like a wet... His hand was like a wet fish. I didn't have... No kite, I didn't... No control. The officers that we had there, yes, I could go anywhere and do anything, but this man, you could see he was... Well... Who am I to say what a politician was like? I compare him with the way I used soldiers to be, I suppose.
Yeah. But he doesn't sound as though he was a man's man who would,
Well, once
be able to stand his corner against people hustling him like Amin.
Yes. Idi Amin led him on, took over, didn't he?
Party in stores, shutters.
When I left, I got to the stage where I was the last one there, last one in the unit. And I went on leave to Mombasa. When I came back, I was ready to... I was to be posted away.
What did you feel about leaving the country?
I was disappointed in a way, but I knew I had to go. Well, I was disappointed because I knew that I had done a good job. I knew I'd done a job. I'd had the facilities and the cash to be able to look after that army the way I always wanted to be able to look after things in the British Army. But because I was the only one there to do it and had no one to, no committee or no one to argue about it, I was able to do it quickly and cheaply and efficiently. So I went away knowing that I'd done a good job. And I knew that when I got back, there was no job to go to in the British Army. I had to wait. I was posted to England, and I knew it. But back in the farewell do, the Archimester was later, became a quartermaster. He was promoted then in my, as I left. I've got him a photograph of them there. He then arranged a party. But unfortunately, there was this feeling within the unit where they had to be careful who they were friends with. So, in the stores, they put the shutters down, 6 foot, 2 6-foot tables up, and there was my party of our staff, all my staff, of course, and the odd officer who I knew very well, from Sandhurst, two of them, and others, I think three or four. But the others were not invited or didn't want to come because I think it's the start of the tribalism. So
that had really come in.
Yes. So really, that was a private party for me. And I was very touched with that in a way. Because they risked. I could see what they were doing. They were risking, especially the officers. They were risking their careers.
Did you get any sense of how they thought things would be after you as the last British person had gone? Because things were going to be different then.
Well, the Israelis were training them. Still. And they didn't like that. That was the first thing. They changed over. I don't think they lasted about 12 months. But it was all being done free. So I think that was fair enough from their point of view. And we trained up. The Africans were... They could look after themselves. Except for sophisticated training, but they were gradually being sent on courses. And later on, the chap who took over for me came to England on a course, and he came to stay with me in Winchester.
Right.
So I followed it, and I followed on with it.
Yeah, and you trained him up to do your job.
Yes.
Yeah. What was his name? Do
you
remember?
Yeah, well, funny name, yeah.
Never mind.
Is on the tip of my tongue now. Anyhow, it was a wonderful man. I took him round on a weekend training course with the TA who I was then attached to, the Hampshire Regiment, and I took him on a weekend on the training, and he stayed with me for 4 or 5 days. But he was on a course in Tidworth.
Yeah.
And I also befriended two more officers who came from the Uganda Army to be trained in Tidworth and took them around the countryside. Yes, I kept in touch with them. Mm.
Mm. So you left Uganda and you flew back to the UK.
Well, no job.
Like?
Pardon?
What was that like, that feeling? I mean.
Well, the funny thing actually, to get away, when I got to Entebbe, my wife and I, we had somebody shadowing us to look after us, I suppose, to get us out of the country, I think. Anyway, we went to Rome. I'd arranged. I thought, well. On the way, I might as well call into Rome and see a few places I'd called in before. So my wife and I had a good trip to Rome. And then back to Winchester, where I was attached to the 4th Battalion, the Hampshire Regiment.
Right. So was this was not of your choice. So how different was it changing regiments like that?
Well, it was difficult in a way, not difficult work-wise, because it was a weekend job and a night job, and it was a TA unit. But they treated me exceptionally well, but I was not doing... I knew I was not... I'd come from a job where I was doing something worthwhile to a job where anyone could have done it. It was not quite what I wanted.
Yeah. And where was that?
That was in Winchester.
Winchester, yeah.
Very nice quarter I had there. Then I bought a house there.
Right. And what year would this be?
Winchester, 1967.
Right. Okay. And what rank were you at this time?
I was major then.
You were major. So yes. When did you get made up to major?
In Uganda. My promotion was time. When I was promoted, I was a full lieutenant from WO.
Yeah.
And then I became a captain after 3 years, and I became a major after another 4 years.
Right.
It was time.
Yeah. Had you ever imagined when you joined up that you'd become an officer in the end?
No. Well, once I joined the... before I joined up, I thought I'd find it difficult to make the grade. It's only when I arrived I found that I was all right. I was pretty well on top of the quality of required. Mm. Then I had all the training throughout the army, much which I've obtained myself, but it was all available through the army, so it was hard work, but everything was there. Mm. Helpful.
So the army gave you all that training?
Everything was there in the army, especially before the war. It's just a matter you had to apply yourself to it.
So, TA Regiment, what was that like and what was your...
They were wonderful people there. Wonderful people there, but it was not any work. I was playing golf in the afternoons. The only work I had to do was really look after the unit, which evening they would have classes 3 nights a week, training 3 nights a week, weekends. And the rest was just office work. So it was not what I wanted, but there we are. There was nowhere else to go, because the army was running down. So I got a bit bored with that. And after 1960, after about 12 months, 18 months, the army was reducing, and they were offering... this unit I was working with disbanded. So therefore I had no job for about 6 months. One looking back, I suppose it could have been a good holiday. But I was playing golf all day in Winchester and just waiting for a posting, but the army couldn't decide really how many troops they're going to retain. So they offered people who wanted to leave the army a golden burler, as he called it. Not very golden, but still. So I thought to myself, well, I might as well take the money. And my wife and I had thought for years of leaving the UK and going overseas. We travelled to so many countries, and we decided over the years, discussing with other people, whether to go to Malta. We thought, no, that's not, I've been there, I wouldn't like to live there, it's too wild and too... not very comfortable to live permanently. Thought of the Bahamas, and we had papers for that, and we thought, well, no, that's too far away and too expensive. We thought of Portugal, and then we'd been there and found that everybody there was so miserable, very, very miserable in those days, because it was a bad time for them politically. Then we thought of Spain, which we'd been there for a while, and everybody was cheerful and happy and sort of sunny and close to England. So I decided I would put my papers in. So I left 12 months before I was... I could have gone on another 12 months.
Right, so that was in
1968. Well, I was so... being used to such work, hard work all my life, I was bored.
Yeah. So what was... how did the army deal with you leaving them? Was there, any ceremonials, demob or...
Before the battalion disbanded, we had a farewell do, and I had two mugs given me, drinking mugs with my name on it, set of cufflinks, had a nice farewell do, and it was good. They treated me. I was treated better on a farewell by those the TA unit than my units, because I'd had to leave my unit so quickly at other times. It wasn't the place where we had time for farewell dues and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So, out of the army, for the first time since, 1934.
Yeah.
So you'd never really been an adult except in the army, had you? I mean, your whole life had been as a soldier.
That's right, yeah.
So did you feel a bit lost? Had you lost a family?
No, I had switchly realised, I could see that I had to now start a new career, and I thought, well, I had my pension, which in those days was not like it is today, but it was sufficient, and which I had reduced somewhat to have some more money in the kitty, to go to Spain to make to build a house and retire. But it didn't quite work out like that. I bought a car and a car man, and stacked up my carpets and odd things for home, piled it up, and went off to south of through Spain to see where I would settle, knowing it had to be Spain because it's so close to home. My people, just the ideal place. And I found the ideal place at the place called Marbella on the outskirts. I parked in the camping site there, but after a few days I realised that camping sites were not for me. I'd done my camping and I'd been used to comfort, and I wasn't going to then finish up having dirty lavatories and dirty showers. So I looked around for some land, and I found some land very close to Marbella, walking distance of Marbella, and arranged for a house to be built. And we looked at the plans and we altered a bit. My wife and I, we had different ideas, and we changed the plans a bit. And where in Spain, the Spanish people built places with terraces with curved Moroccan type curved, I forget what to call it.
Well, the terraces.
Terraces, the entrance to it. So we said we won't have it curved, we'll have it straight with a slight curve at the top, and made more space. We still had the sun protection. And we did that, and they said, no, you can't do that. But we did do it. And then we wanted the grills on the wall, on the walls. We wanted them green. They said, no, you can't do that. You have to have black. No, we have green. So we had green. Okay. A few years later, they had the same all over the country.
Okay, well, we better leave you in Spain, as they say. It's been a fascinating story. Are there any other stories you want to add in? We go back to Palestine and Italy and
I didn't stay in Spain, by the way.
Oh, right.
No, I stayed in Spain, but after Chalmers I got bored, I went diamond mining.
Oh, right. And where?
In Sierra Leone.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had 2 years diamond mining there. Coming back and forwards to Spain, you know.
Right. What, organising?
No, I was security.
Actually doing it?
Security.
Security?
Oh, it was very...
How did you get that job?
Well, I saw it in the Telegraph, advertised for ex-military. And when I got there, the security people were composed of ex-officers of the Army, Air Force and Navy.
Oh, really?
So it was really... And I worked there with a Land Rover and a driver, or dressed and rifle and all that. It was semi-military. It was very good, really.
So you got that job, obviously, as a result of your extensive experience in Africa.
Yes, experience it was. And, of course, they thought, in the British Army, if you're in trouble, you lose your pension. So the new people couldn't go out there and do what you probably would want to do, is steal the dams.
So what do you think of the army pension?
Well, when I got to Spain, I found that the army pension didn't increase with the cost of living. It didn't here either. And when I arrived there, I found that widows, army widows out there, are living on a pension which they had 10 years before, which hadn't got it with the cost of living. And I realised that mine was no going to be any good in 5 years' time. But fortunately, the civil servants in this country, they'd arranged that the pensions would have got up with the cost of living. So we automatically got the same. So then it became reasonable.
Right. Arthur Caney, end of reel 14.